Hello everyone, welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, August 11th. I'm Kevin Rogers at the microphone, glad to have you listening as always. We have a very warm day underway in Fort Dodge and it's going to stay warm for a couple more days, but I do believe there's an end in sight of some of this warm weather, so we'll take a more detailed look at the forecast as we conclude our time together. Planners are opposed to the travel center rezoning, and the proposal now goes to the county supervisors. That is the first article in today's Messenger. There's a picture of Donna Faith as she voices her concerns about traffic safety near a proposed travel center at the intersection of US Highway 20 and Poplar Avenue. She lives near the proposed center. She shared her concerns during the Webster County Planning and Zoning meeting Tuesday night. Also in the picture are Tony Gustafson, District 1 engineer for the Iowa Department of Transportation, and Cody Finch, transportation and team leader from McClure Engineering. A plan to create a travel center east of Fort Dodge near US Highway 20 hit an obstacle Tuesday evening when a county government panel voted against the necessary rezoning. The Webster County Planning and Zoning Commission voted 5-2 to recommend denying the switch from the agriculture preservation designation to a general commercial one. The commission's vote is a recommendation to the Board of Supervisors, which will have the final say on the matter. Kevin Stump, the property owner who is seeking to develop the center, said he will ask the supervisors to rezone the property as he requested. "I'm disappointed, yes," he said after Tuesday evening's meeting. He said he was really disappointed that commission members were still concerned about traffic safety, even though he had McClure Engineering Company of Fort Dodge prepare a plan to redesign the intersection of US Highway 20 and Poplar Avenue. During Tuesday's meeting, Tony Gustafson, District 1 engineer for the Iowa Department of Transportation, told the commission that his agency has approved the intersection plan proposed by McClure Engineering. "We don't have any concerns," he said. Stump has proposed building the travel center on land he owns on the northwest side of the intersection of US Highway 20 and Poplar Avenue. He envisions a 9,750 square foot building housing a convenience store on one side and a coffee shop and restaurant on the other side. Gasoline, diesel fuel pumps along with charging stations for electric vehicles would be outside. He also wants to create an enclosed dog park and trail connection leading to the nearby Holiday Creek Nature Area. The site would be along Poplar Avenue, about 400 feet north of US Highway 20. Stump has estimated that it would cost $6 million to develop the travel center. He has asked the county to rezone 24 acres to allow its creation. The Planning and Zoning Commission first considered the idea on April 13th. At that time, it postponed any action until the traffic study was received. Expecting a large crowd, county officials moved Tuesday's meeting to the large courtroom on the third floor of the courthouse. At the beginning of the meeting, Commission Chairwoman Margot Knipple urged people to keep their emotions in check. During the meeting, four people spoke against the plan, some of them coming to the podium repeatedly. They cited concerns about traffic safety at the intersection, future commercial development at the site, bright lights shining onto their property, loss of water in their wells, and trash blowing onto their properties. In addition to Stump, three people spoke in favor of the project. Most touted the economic value of the project. One man applauded the integrity of the Stump family. Commission members seemed most concerned about creating illegal spot zoning if they recommended approval of the project. They indicated that they did not want to create an island of commercial property surrounded by farmland. "I don't think anybody up here thinks your project is bad," Knipple said to Stump. But she said to rezone the site as requested would go against the county's future land use and comprehensive plans. "As a planner, I have to look at the entire county," she said. She added that approving spot zoning would make it appear to planners and developers that Webster County doesn't actually have a comprehensive plan. Commission members John Anderson, Daniel Doster, Laura Kelly, Berna Tucker, and Knepo voted to recommend denial of the zoning change. Commission members Gary Nelson and Tommy Smith voted against that move. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, Feenstra sees good things in the infrastructure bill. The House has not voted on this measure yet. The $1 trillion infrastructure bill approved by the Senate Tuesday contains, quote, a lot of interesting good pieces for rural Iowa, end quote, said U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra. The Republican congressman from Hull, who represents Webster County and all of its surrounding counties, told the Messenger Tuesday morning that he believes there is funding for many beneficial things in the measure. Among them, he said, are broadband, roads, bridges, water mains, and sewers. However, he did not say that he would vote for the bill when it comes before the House of Representatives. He said he wants to read the bill, quote, to make sure what we talked about is in the final package, end quote. He says it's unclear when the bill will be brought up in the House. Feenstra said he will vote against the Congressional Democrats' $3.5 trillion human services bill. That has a lot more concerns, he said. I will not be supporting that bill. He said the United States is in a, quote, debt crisis. He added that inflation is rising because of all the recent federal government spending. That just eats away at a person's income, he said. In Washington, he said there are only very limited discussions about balancing the federal budget. Iowa law prohibits the state government from spending more than 99% of the revenue it takes in. The federal government could learn something from Iowa, Feenstra said. I think we can use Iowa as a model for the rest of the country, he said. In an unrelated matter, Feenstra reported that his effort to get aid for Iowa farmers whose crops and buildings were flattened by the August 2020 derecho storm is advancing. His proposed amendment that would permit farmers to get derecho help from a program that provides relief to farmers impacted by wildfires, hurricanes, and hurricanes has been passed by the House. Heading back to the main page of the Messenger, IACCT welcomes a new director. Emily Shields, the new executive director of the Iowa Association of Community College Trustees, was introduced to the Iowa Central Community College Board of Directors Tuesday evening. From the article, at Tuesday's regular meeting of the Iowa Central Community College Board of Directors, Iowa Central board member Daryl Detterman introduced Emily Shields as the new executive director of the Iowa Association of Community College Trustees. The IACCT website states it is a, quote, nonprofit corporation organized exclusively for the purpose of promoting social welfare by strengthening, developing, and correlating the work of its members, the community college boards, and promoting civic betterment and social improvements allowed by law. Shields grew up near Cedar Rapids and developed a passion for community colleges while watching her father attain his associate degree over the course of several years in night school. She said, I remember helping him and seeing his notes, and it just made a huge difference to him. And so that was my first introduction to not just the importance of education, but the importance of community colleges specifically. Shields attended the University of Iowa, majoring in political science and journalism. After college, she traveled all over, living in places like London, Texas, and Washington, D.C. Ultimately, she decided to make her way back to Iowa. She said, big cities have a lot, but they just can't compete with being able to get home to be with your kids by 4:30 in the afternoon. Shields and her family have lived in Des Moines for around 16 years. Once she returned to Iowa, she worked in the governor's office, mainly on education policy, giving her the opportunity to become familiar with the state's community colleges. Then for the past 9 years, she also ran an organization called Campus Compact, working with colleges and universities in Iowa and Minnesota. Shields said she is excited about this position and feels community colleges like Iowa Central are starting to get more respect. I really feel like this is our moment, and I'm very excited to get to work with community colleges right now because I think we're at such a unique time where people are maybe finally seeing the light and seeing what an important part of the education system community colleges are, and we're getting the support and attention we deserve. Shields began work with IACCT in January and feels like they are already making great strides in the legislature. I'm really so impressed with how well we execute on having one voice for advocacy that is so rare to see for a statewide association. And we really do it very well, and that results in strong outcomes, she said. We were able to just continue to fight for local control and local decision, making when it comes to programs, and I think that will continue to be a conversation. Shields said IACCT's main goals for the next year are working on more representation for community colleges. The biggest thing to know is that community college minds come last, so we're sort of at the very end of the process, she said. All the other lines get drawn, and then we get our turn, but we'll be working with the Department of Education on that process and ensuring we're well represented there. Iowa Central Community College President Dr. Jesse Ulbricht gave an update on the upcoming semester. He said they are excited to welcome back students and staff in the next few weeks and are looking forward to a great semester getting back to face-to-face classes. Currently between part-time and full-time students, Iowa Central has around 3,700 students registered for the fall semester. Fort Dodge City Council members Lydia Scher and Kim Allstott are running for re-election. Scher is seeking her second term as an at-large member of the council. Allstott is seeking his sixth term representing Ward 4, which is the north central part of the city. Fort Dodge is a great place to live, and I would like to have an opportunity to continue working towards progress and growth in our community, Scher said. Scher of 1040 North 19th Street is the communications specialist for the Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance. She is a graduate of St. Edmund High School who earned an associate degree from Iowa Central Community College and a bachelor's degree from Buena Vista University in Storm Lake. Scher is a member of the board of the Gene Giraffe Project, which supports children suffering from rare diseases. She also serves on the boards of the Youth Shelter Care of North Central Iowa, YWCA, and the Joy Mobile. She is also a member of the Drug Court Steering Committee, and the Study Club. Kim Allstott is a retired business owner who lives at 1232 North 7th Street. He is a native of Fort Dodge who graduated from Fort Dodge Senior High School. He earned an associate degree from Iowa Central Community College. He is a veteran of the Iowa Army National Guard. He is chairman of the board for the Salvation Army in Fort Dodge. He also is vice chairman of the board for the Heart of Iowa Housing Trust Fund. Allstott serves on the board of Webster County Crime Stoppers. He is a volunteer with Pride and Community Appearance and Main Street, Fort Dodge. The Fort Dodge city election process has begun as nomination petitions are now being accepted. Fort Dodge voters will elect a mayor and 6 of the 7 city council members this year. Nominating petitions are being accepted at the city clerk's office. 3 incumbents, Mayor Matt Bemrick and council members Kim Allstott and Lydia Scher, have already announced their re-election bids. The general election will be held November 2nd. A primary election, if necessary, will be held on October 5th, but a primary election will only be held for races in which there are more than 2 candidates. The 2 top vote-getters in a primary election would advance to the general election. The at-large council seats on the ballot this year are held by Scher and Councilman Jeff Halter. All 4 council seats elected from the city wards will be filled during this election. Those seats are held by Terry Menke in Ward 1, Andy Fritz in Ward 2, Dave Flattery in Ward 3, and Allstott in Ward 4. Just 1 council seat, the at-large seat held by Councilman Nevin Conrad, is not on the ballot this year. To get on the ballot, candidates must file nominating petitions and affidavits of candidacy at the city clerk's office in the municipal building at 819 First Avenue South. The petitions must be signed by a specified number of people based on the number of people who voted for that office in the last general election. The minimum number of signatures required for each office: for mayor, 62, council at large, 55, council ward 1 and 2 need 10, council ward 3, 17, council ward 4, 16. Ward 1 includes western Fort Dodge, part of downtown, and Pleasant Valley. Ward 2 is the southern portion of the city. Ward 3 is the northeastern part of the city. Ward 4 is the north central part of the city. All nomination papers must be filed by August 5th. All nomination papers must be filed by 5 p.m. on August 26th. A Fort Dodge man serving two life sentences for a pair of murders is asking the Iowa Supreme Court for further review on his conviction appeal after the Iowa Court of Appeals upheld his convictions last month. Tanner John King, age 30, was convicted by a Story County jury in December 2019 of the October 2018 slayings of brothers Marion and L. Dominic Rhodes of Fort Dodge. The Rhodes brothers were gunned down near downtown Fort Dodge on October 22, 2018. The brothers' bodies were found in an alley behind King's apartment building near 2nd Avenue North and North 9th Street. King was identified as a suspect, questioned, and eventually charged with the double murder. The trial was moved to Story County after an impartial jury was unable to be selected in Webster County. After a three-week-long trial, the jury deliberated for about 14 hours before finding King guilty of the two counts of first-degree murder on December 4, 2019. He was later sentenced to two consecutive terms of life in prison without the possibility of parole and has been incarcerated at the Iowa State Penitentiary at Fort Madison. King first appealed his convictions on the grounds that law enforcement failed to follow up on leads that would have led them to conclude another person, Cleisho Clark, committed the murders, and that the district court erred in its decision to not allow testimony from a witness that would have included, quote, word on the street, end quote, information about Clark allegedly being the killer. The Iowa Court of Appeals filed its ruling affirming King's two convictions on July 21st. King now awaits to see if the Iowa Supreme Court will accept his further review application. The state's highest court grants just a fraction of the further review applications it receives. A Wisconsin man who was sentenced to life in prison for killing a fellow inmate at the Fort Dodge Correctional Facility has filed his notice of appeal in district court. Eric T. Hall, 45, was convicted on May 18th by a Webster County jury of first-degree murder for the death of Fort Dodge Correctional Facility inmate Thomas Dulesky. Hall was sentenced to the mandatory sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole on July 30th. Hall attacked Dulesky in the victim's cell at the correctional facility on June 14, 2020. Dulesky, age 59, was found to be unresponsive in his cell in the Grove unit of the prison around 5:15 p.m. on that date. As a Class A felony, first-degree murder carries a mandatory life sentence under Iowa law. District Court Judge John Flynn also ordered that Hall pay $150,000 in victim restitution to Thomas Dulesky's next of kin. Now that Hall has filed his notice of appealing his conviction, he will be assigned a state public appellate attorney to write and file the appeal. A Fort Dodge man has been arrested after a three-hour standoff with police. There's a picture of Fort Dodge Police Captain Dennis Quinn as he leads Michael Eckner, 31, to a squad car Tuesday afternoon after a three-hour standoff with police resulted in his arrest. From the article, a Fort Dodge man with outstanding warrants was arrested without incident Tuesday afternoon following a three-hour-long standoff with police. According to a press release from the Fort Dodge Police Department, officers responded to the area of 536 South 22nd Street shortly after 2:30 p.m. after receiving information that an individual with outstanding warrants was in the area. Police were able to approach the individual, Michael William Eckner II, 31, and confirmed he had outstanding warrants. He then locked himself in a business located at 536 South 22nd Street and refused to exit. Heavy police presence was on scene for several hours as negotiators talked with the suspect. He was wanted for violation of the Sex Offender Registry, second or subsequent offense, a Class D felony, and for violation of parole. He was convicted of a third-degree sexual abuse in Ida County in 2009. Shortly before 6:30 p.m., Eckner surrendered, and was taken into custody without incident. According to Fort Dodge PD Captain Ryan Gruenberg, officers treated the situation as though he was armed with something that could be used as a weapon, but he was ultimately taken into custody unarmed. He will have his initial appearance in Webster County Magistrate Court on Wednesday. The Fort Dodge PD was assisted on the scene by the Webster County Sheriff's Office, the Fort Dodge Fire Department, and the Webster County Attorney's Office. We'll take a look at from our files. From our files takes us back to August 2006. 15 short years ago, there are pictures in the Messenger of several cold air funnels, including one shown south of Otho, that were spotted, prompting several citizens to call the Webster County Law Enforcement Center. Cold air funnels are weak tornadoes formed in a cold air mass. Certainly looks like a tornado, and I'd want to know about it too. From our files also takes us back to August 2006, 15 years ago. There's a picture of nurse's aide Lisa Hartwig as she holds Roscoe, who looks like a golden retriever for Gallery Care Center resident Opal Anderson. For her to pet, Center Administrator Diane Panzi credits a perfect rating from state inspections and appeals officials to resident-centered initiatives and attentive staff. Excuse me. Let's head over to the news of record next and take a look at what they have there for us. Fort Dodge police logs from Sunday include a runaway, 1st Avenue North and North 7th Street, a theft in the 1800 block of 1st Avenue South, unknown problem in the 1000 block of South 32nd Street, and a suspicious person in the 700 block of 8th Avenue North. On Monday, they had unknown problems in the 400 block of South 14th Street and the 400 block of North 15th Street. A loud party in the 1200 block of 1st Avenue North, juvenile problems North 15th Street, 24th Avenue North, an assault 1300 block Avenue C, trespassing 10 block North 25th Street, hit and run 1200 block South 19th Street, theft in the 3000 block of 5th Avenue South, intoxicated pedestrian 300 block 1st Avenue South, a civil disturbance in the 2100 block of 2nd and a half Avenue North, criminal mischief 2600 block 18th Avenue North, harassment 800 block South 32nd Street, theft 200 block Avenue E, suspicious person 600 block Central Avenue, theft 3000 block 1st Avenue South, unknown problem 200 block 2nd Street Northwest, harassment 1000 block Central Avenue, suspicious person 1200 block 3rd Avenue Northwest, theft 3000 block 1st Avenue South, a prowler in the 1400 block of 9th Avenue South, an unknown problem in the 900 block of Riverside Drive Northwest, theft in the 700 block of South 17th Street, an assault in the 900 block of North 16th Street, suspicious person 200 block South 14th Street, unknown problem 1700 block 5th Avenue South, juvenile problems in the 2300 block of 5th Avenue South. Magistrate Court on Tuesday, driving while barred, Angel Matanas Santana, 33 of Fort Dodge, preliminary hearing waived, transferred to District Court. Ryan Ray Andrews, 43 of Fort Dodge, driving under suspension and no insurance, fined $347.50 for each offense. Operating while under the influence, first offense, Lindy K. Flatow, 43 of Humboldt, preliminary hearing set for August 27th. Speeding, Lindy K. Flatow, 43 of Humboldt, continued 180 days. Public intoxication, Kenneth Wayne Johnson, 25 of Fort Dodge, fined $180.75. Going to head over next to the Messenger editorial page. Today's Messenger editorial is entitled, Nothing Compares to the Iowa State Fair. Don't miss your chance to sample this amazing annual event. What may well be the grandest of our nation's state agricultural festivities, the Iowa State Fair is underway. Iowans gathered in Fairfield for the first state fair in 1854, just 8 years after achieving statehood. The fair boasted an attendance of about 8,000 people. In the early years, the fair's venue changed frequently. It wasn't until 1879 that Des Moines became its home. It took up residence at the present site, rather, in 1886. The more than 160 years that have elapsed since the State Fair began have witnessed many changes, but agriculture was then and remains today central to the state's economic life. In the 21st century, the Iowa State Fair continues to celebrate agriculture, but also highlights and exhibits, and through entertainment, countless other aspects of a contemporary American life. For the many 4-H'ers and FFA members from all across Iowa who have worked hard throughout the year on assorted projects, the State Fair represents the final and most prestigious stage of exhibition and competition. This year's fair runs from Thursday through August 22nd. The more than 1 million visitors expected to pay a call at the Iowa State Fairgrounds will not only be amused and entertained, but also will have ample opportunities for educational enrichment. The 2021 Iowa State Fair has so much to offer that no preview can fully capture the variety. Among its features are one of the planet's grandest livestock shows, what organizers tout as the century's largest state fair foods department, about 900 classes, Iowa's largest art show, literally hundreds of competitive events and contests, well in excess of 600 exhibitors and concessionaires, grandstand entertainment that covers an immense range of tastes. The facilities are spread across 400 acres and include 160 acres of campgrounds. Some of the fair buildings are examples of classic exposition-style architecture dating from the late 19th century and early 20th century. The mix of fully modern structures with venues that recall earlier eras give the State Fair both a charm and functionality that are truly remarkable. Visits to many of its locales are a multi-generational family tradition. Fun coupled with nostalgia are very much the order of the day for countless visitors. If you haven't already made plans to head to the fair, there's ample time to reconsider. People travel from all over the nation and journey from many foreign lands to partake of the extraordinary experience that is the Iowa State Fair. Don't miss out on a world-class event right in your own backyard. See you at the fair. And that is today's Messenger editorial. We'll take a look next at some articles from the Daily Freeman Journal. Cool drinks on a hot day is the title of a short article in the Freeman Journal. Looks like there was a photo in the paper showing three young entrepreneurs serving up some refreshing treats on a hot, humid day. Kaysen Wig, age 8, Tyler Wig, 4, and Brindley Wig, age 10, were manning a lemonade and baked goods stand in the 700 block of First Street Tuesday. They poured passers-by glasses of lemonade or water and also offered some yummy baked goods for sale. Looking at the Marshalltown Times-Republican, the Connect with Paranormal Fest is coming up. Midwest Annual Paranormal Fest is set to make its debut in Marshalltown from August 20th through the 22nd at Riverview Park, located at 402 Woodland Street. Organizer Kelly Steffen said different speakers and healers will be on tap for the weekend. We have shamans, ministers, pastors, priests, every aspect of a healer you can think of will be down there, and it means so much to me because this town for the last 3 years has been in so much pain and so much depression, Stefan said. So many people hurting, so many people struggling, and it was just important to me to have it here. The event is set to have vendors, speakers, VIP, guided tours, and more. Stefan said it was important to her to bring in different types of people from the paranormal world. I want to give the community a place where everybody in their own way has somebody to connect with, she said. At the same time, we have the speakers, we have the celebrities, we have the entertainment, so it's not totally focused on that. This is the first time ever the event is being held in Marshalltown. However, there were plans to have it in town years prior, but like other events, the 2018 tornado, the pandemic, and the 2020 derecho, things were put on hold. It wasn't just COVID, this started before the tornado, she said. We continued planning the festival as we started putting the planning back in place, and then we had the derecho. That was the next year that we were going to get it going, and we had to cancel it that year. Stefan says she expects there to be 3,000 to 5,000 attendees. when I see the tickets that are being purchased and the inquiries and where they're coming from, I can make ballpark figures based off of that. And that's where we came up with our numbers, she said. Stefan said the festival has drawn interest from across the country as well as internationally. We have people coming from California, Florida, New York. We've got two guys coming from Canada. These are just the ones that I know of, she said. In addition to the vendors, there are going to be celebrities at the event. This includes Travis Walton, who was allegedly abducted by aliens on November 5th, 1975 in Arizona. Two of the co-workers that allegedly saw the abduction, Steve Pierce and John Goulet, are also expected to be in town. The reason that this is so special is so and so important is because these guys have not spoke together in the same place for over a decade. They just don't do it, Stefan said. So for us to be able to bring them together to do another panel and speak to the public, it's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. According to Stefan, the Travel Channel and potentially other television networks are sending reporters to town to cover his appearance at the event. In addition to Walton, other speakers who are expected to be there include authors such as Chad Lewis, Ashley Green, and filmmakers Josh Hurd, Michelle Barron, David Glidden, Chris Coyote Sutton, and more. Stefan said Lewis, who does cryptids, has appeared on the Travel Channel and Discovery Channel, while Sutton, a shaman and a filmmaker, is working with Nick Groff, who used to be on the show Ghost Adventures. An item signed by Groff will be offered in a raffle. According to Stefan, a surprise will be at a Saturday panel. There is no cost to attend the event, but there is a fee for the VIP tour. Stefan said not charging an admission fee was very important to her. The people who are going to get the most out of this event are the people that we will be punishing if we were to charge a ticket to get in there. Certain vendors are also expected to be in attendance. Items that are expected to be top sellers are crystals and oils. Other vendors include aura, photography, food, and clothing. Individuals age 16 and older can attend, but people age 16 to 18 must be accompanied by an adult to attend the event. The VIP tickets must be bought ahead of time. No schedule of events has been published, but the VIP events are set for Friday and Saturday. More information can be found on the Midwest Annual Paranormal Festival's Facebook page or on its website. You're listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituary page. Marjorie Betton. Marjorie Ann Betton died August 7th, 2021. With her family surrounding her, services will be 10:30 Saturday, August 14th at the West Des Moines United Methodist Church, 720 Grand Avenue in West Des Moines. Visitation is Friday from 5 to 7 at Hamilton's on Westtown Parkway in West Des Moines. A private family burial will be held after the service. She is survived by her three children, Laura Collins, John Holtorf, Jean Holtorf, her sister Phyllis Lewis, stepchildren, two granddaughters, Sarah and Jana, three grandsons, Eric, Stefan, and Luke, and two great-granddaughters, Addison and Maya. Three sons preceded her in death, Ray Holtorf at age 43, and two infants, Robbie and Eric. Born on a farm in Denison in 1933 to Ray and Adelaide North, Marjorie finished high school and married Jean Holtorf in 1951. Moving to Iowa City, she worked at the athletic department under Forrest Evashevsky and helping her husband finish dental school. Their daughter, Laura, was born in Iowa City. Service with the United States Public Health Service took them to San Francisco, where their son, John, was born 13 months later. 16 months later, following the next transfer to New London, Connecticut, with the Coast Guard Academy, they welcomed Gene Jr. Their last assignment was in Boston. Living on both coasts was an exciting experience for a young farm girl. Returning from service, they set up a private dental practice in Fort Dodge. Divorced after 20 years, she married a local funeral director in 1973, Bob Gunderson, who died from cancer in 1989. She was very civic-minded, involved in many organizations, was a beautiful seamstress, and played duplicate in party bridge. She was alto soloist in the Messiah, joined church choir at the age of 14, sang in a quartet in New London, Connecticut, and sang with the Fort Dodge Civic Glee Club for several years. She also taught piano, guitar, bridge, and an antique class at Iowa Central Community College. Collecting antiques was a lifelong passion. As a member of the Presbyterian Church, she served as deacon, chairman of the women's group, choir member, camp counselor, Sunday school teacher, and Bible study leader. While running the funeral home with her husband, she became president of the YWCA. Following Bob's death, she moved to San Diego, joining the La Jolla Presbyterian Church and the Navy League. She made wonderful friends while enjoying the company of her niece, Jackie Johnson, with season tickets to Disney World, SeaWorld, the San Diego Opera and San Diego Chargers, and plays and musicals in Los Angeles. Returning to Iowa, she married Dwayne Benton of Boone, who also preceded her in death in 2013. She was a 50-year member of PEO, serving as president of Chapter JX in Fort Dodge, president of Chapter PT in San Diego, president of Chapter FY in Des Moines, and then belonging to Chapter NP in Boone and MS in Des Moines. She loves sewing, bridge, singing, reading, playing the piano and guitar, and antiques. She never met a thrift shop she didn't love, but her greatest love was for her family. Memorials may be directed to the charity of your choice, and condolences expressed at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. Estrella Farlander. Estrella Joyce Marshall Farlander of Idaloo, Texas, died Friday, August 6, 2021. Estrella was born April 4, 1933 in Roswell, New Mexico. A beloved wife, mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, and great-great-grandmother, she was blessed. Estrella, a devoted servant for the Lord, served many children in women's ministries at the Rawls, Idaloo, and Westside Churches of Christ. She was preceded in death by her husband, Joe, son, W.J., parents, Gerald and Delta, Oda Marshall, Bill Driscoll, her son-in-law, and Jeffrey Swanson, a great-grandson. She is survived by daughters Carolyn Anderson, Adona Driscoll, Dee Murphy, Tabitha Rogers, grandchildren Sisty, Gerald, Deona, Drew, Samantha, Heather, Brad, Chris, Donalya, Danielle, Nikita, and Megan, along with 24 great-grandchildren and 2 great-great-grandchildren. She served as a rural route mail carrier in Rawls for over 46 years. She enjoyed quilting, sewing, reading, gardening, and working in her flower beds. Viewing is 6 to 8 on Friday, August 13th at Adams Funeral Home in Rawls, Texas. Burial at 10 a.m. on August 14th in Roswell, New Mexico at the South Park Cemetery. And her memorial service will be held at the Idaloo, Texas Church of Christ on August 14th, 2021 at 4 p.m. Central Time. There will be a celebration of life in Fort Dodge at a future date. Laufesweiler Funeral Home is in charge of local arrangements. Dwight Krebs. Dwight Joseph Krebs, 75, died at his home in Manson on November 1st, 2020. A prayer vigil, including recitation of the rosary, will be held at the Larson Weishauer Funeral Home in Manson on Saturday, August 14th, beginning at 1 o'clock p.m. There will be visitation and social time beginning at 12:15 until the time of service, burial in St. Thomas Catholic Cemetery in Manson. Dwight Joseph Krebs was born July 25, 1945, in Rolfe, the son of Elmer and Isabel Coughlin Krebs. He graduated from Barnum High School and in July of 1965 enlisted into the United States Air Force. He was honorably discharged from the Air Force on December 18, 1968. He was then employed at Farmers Cooperative Elevator in Manson for the next 42 years, retiring on January 28, 2011. He is survived by his brother Gary, sister Isabel Pressey, stepsister Diana Snow, sister-in-law Diana Krebs, stepsister-in-law Jody Simpson, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, his sister Sue, and husband John Thoma, stepmother Betty Simpson Krebs, brothers Dennis and Randy Krebs, infant sister Mary, and a stepbrother Robert Simpson. Raymond Forsyth. Raymond Forsyth, 85, of Fort Dodge, died Monday, August 9th at his home. Mass of Christian burial is 10:30 a.m. on Friday, August 13th at Holy Trinity Church. A private family burial will be held in the West Bend Township Cemetery. Visitation is 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday at Laufesweiler Funeral Home. And that is the extent of today's obituary page. We'll head next to the Messenger Sports section. TikTok is the title of the first article as coaches and players react to the Iowa High School basketball shot clock news. From a strategic point of view, the general consensus seems to be that Tuesday's shot clock decision will barely move the needle. Situationally, though, area coaches and players alike expect pockets of the game to change, and for the better, beginning in 2022-23. The Iowa High School Athletic Association and the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union made a joint announcement that, in accordance with the recent suggestion by the National Federation of State High School Associations, all varsity prep basketball games will require a 35-second shot clock after this coming school year. According to the IHSAA press release on Tuesday, 35 seconds was the timing provided by NFHS approval. Further shot clock information and rule implementation will be provided by the Athletic Association and Athletic Union as it becomes available ahead of the 22-23 season. Most programs won't be significantly affected by the change, yet there are certain situations, as Fort Dodge girls head coach Scott Messerly pointed out, where the new rule will add a dramatic flair to the waning moments. I was talking to new Fort Dodge Activities Director Josh Porter about it, and we were kind of weighing the pros and cons, Messerly said. It's never seemed to be much of an issue on a night-by-night basis in the CIML. Shots go up pretty quick. I know it won't really change much for us. Now, with that being said, it will come into play at times when a team has a 6 or 8 point lead and is trying to run out the clock, or in the last minute of a quarter when you see some ball holding for a last shot. It could make difference, more of a difference in tight games, especially in the postseason. There's that keep away approach that just won't be possible now, which to me is a good thing. Long-standing shot clock proponents point out low-scoring state basketball scores where both shots and possessions became scarce and points plummeted. Still, that was more the exception than the rule in a broader sense. I think the shot clock is great for us as high school kids, said Fort Dodge's Javian Jondo, who will be a senior for the inaugural season. I think it's great that kids can get into the feel of it early for the style of play if they go on to the collegiate level. But I also think it will make the game better, forcing teams to not hold the ball and get out and run more instead. St. Edmund's senior-to-be Quentin McCarville will miss the rule change by a year. Still, he supports the decision. In my own opinion, I love the shot clock rule, he said. I think it's great for the game, and it helps teams on both sides of the ball. On offense, it can speed up, or you can take control and run the game at your own pace. For defense, you can now know a team has to shoot quicker, so maybe they don't have to foul as much when playing from behind. I think the rule should be a little longer than 35 seconds. I think 40 to 45 seconds would be a great shot clock time for high school. I wish I could experience the shot clock rule, but I'm glad they are doing it no matter what. It's a great idea, and I'm excited to watch some games when they have it in place. Fort Dodge's all CIML point guard senior-to-be Tori Bennett called it a good addition to high school basketball. This will cause the offensive team to have to work for their possession, especially if they are winning and are otherwise wanting to stall the clock, Bennett said. It will speed things up and add a whole new layer to the game. It will finally reward a good defensive team if they can keep a team from scoring too. I'm excited to see how this plays out for Iowa girls basketball. All-State Bishop Garrigan guard Molly Joyce will have one season to experience the new style of play. Personally, I think it's great that a shot clock is coming to high school basketball, Joyce said. It will help create a faster-paced game, as well as rewarding the defense when a team is unable to score in the 35 seconds. It will also stop the stalling. Although it will definitely be a big adjustment for players and coaches, I think it will create a lot more opportunities, she said. A pair of local athletes were lauded for their efforts on the field this summer as the Iowa High School Baseball Coaches Association announced its 2021 All-State squads on Tuesday. St. Edmund senior Grant Heldorfer and Fort Dodge junior Drake Collin landed on the Class 1A and 4A lists, respectively. Heldorfer was a second-team choice. Collin earned a spot on the third team. "It's an honor to be voted into the All-State team," said Heldorfer, also an academic All-State selection. "It feels great for all the work put in during the off-season to finally pay off. I would like to thank Gale head coach Mike Zalot and coach Drew Hansen for getting the team to work in the off-season. I would also like to thank everyone on the team for allowing and building a culture in which hard work is encouraged and appreciated by everyone in the program." Heldorfer carried a team-best 442 batting average. The school's 2021 Griffey Award winner also led St. Edmund in hits, doubles, triples, runs scored, total bases, on-base percentage, and slugging percentage. Collin was tied for fourth in 4A with 32 stolen bases in 33 attempts. He hit .325 and scored 43 runs. On the mound, Collin posted a 5-2 record with more strikeouts than innings pitched. "Obviously, it's a huge accomplishment to be named to an All-State team, but it means more to me that the work I have put into baseball throughout my whole life has started to show," Collin said. "It also means a ton to know that coaches around the state included me in something like this, knowing they see me as that caliber of a player. This is going to continue to motivate me to work hard so I can take the next step in my game, but while continuing to push myself to take the next step, I want to also motivate my teammates to take the next step with me so we can become a state tournament team. Being All-State is outstanding, but it would feel great to be part of a state tournament team in 2022. Webster City teammates Tyler Olson and CJ Hissler land on the second team in 3A, while Pocahontas area's Trey Olerts and Emmitsburg's Lex Castle were third team picks in 2A. Hunter Christensen of New Alfonda was 1A second squad member. Mustang teammates Gabe Severs and Ryan Greenfield were third teamers. The Northern Iowa Panthers are working toward their opener. The Northern Iowa football team has started work towards its season opener as the Panthers will meet Iowa State on September 4th. Mark Farley, who has been in charge of the program for over two decades now, understands the importance of these preseason practices even after playing a modified schedule in the spring. "I'm not changing the way we have camp," Farley said during media days. "I want to get back to what we know and what works." The Panthers will play their first two games on the road, following up a short trip over to Ames with a longer one to California to face Sacramento State. They are set to make their Unidome debut on September 18th versus St. Thomas, who is transitioning to Division I football this year. UNI hosts Youngstown State in the Missouri Valley Football Conference opener on October 2nd and also plays South Dakota, Southern Illinois, and Western Illinois at home. Road dates are set at North Dakota State, South Dakota State, Illinois State, Missouri State, with the FCS playoffs to begin November 27th. This past spring, Northern Iowa went 3-4, finishing second in the league with a 3-3 record. "The excitement comes from walking in the room where there was a full room of people," Farley said. "We haven't had that for 18 months where 105 guys are sitting in a press room getting ready for one common goal." Former Iowa Central standout Spencer Cuvelier is among the list of returning starters and all MVFC players, with Fort Dodge senior high grad and All-Stater Tyson Kershaw on the roster. Manson Northwest Webster graduate Tim Butcher and Bishop Garrigan grad Zach Kibbe are also back on the defense for the Panthers. Kershaw was the top deep threat for UNI, averaging a team-high 22.7 yards per catch as a freshman. He finished with 6 receptions for 136 yards and a touchdown, seeing action in all 6 games. Cuvillier led the team with 71 total tackles. Butcher had 4 tackles, and Kibbe had 2. Heading back to the Marshalltown Times-Republican, the Iowa Veterans Home has seen an outbreak in COVID cases. More than 50 Iowa nursing homes have experienced a COVID-19 outbreak since the vaccine rollout in December. And the home with the highest number of outbreaks is run by the state itself. The Iowa Veterans Home has experienced 5 outbreaks over the course of the pandemic, more than any other long-term care facility in the state of Iowa. According to newly released data from the Iowa Department of Public Health, it has also racked up one of the highest total number of infections. During the first 17 months of the pandemic, the IVH has been in outbreak status, the equivalent of 7 months. The Marshalltown facility is home to roughly 400 veterans, now has a vaccine acceptance rate among the staff of 70%, according to federal officials. The home employs roughly 865 workers. Although IDPH reports only combined staff and resident infection numbers, the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services breaks out and publicly reports resident-only infections. CMS says there have been 31 resident infections at the IVH to date, which suggests that the state-employed workers account for more than 3/4 of the infections at the facility, 115 cases out of 146. The Veterans Home now ranks 4th on the list of Iowa nursing homes with the most COVID-19 infections. The Iowa home with the highest number of infections over the past 17 months is the Good Shepherd Health Center in Cerro Gordo County, where 248 workers or residents have been infected as a result of 2 separate outbreaks at the home, according to Department of Public Health data. Placing 2nd on that list is the Risen Sun Christian Village in Pottawatomie County with 170 infections. The Good Samaritan Home of Ottumwa in Wapello County placed 3rd with 159 infections. 2 of the 5 outbreaks at the Veterans Home occurred after the vaccine rollout in mid-December. A total of five residents of the home have died from COVID-19, according to state and federal officials. COVID-19 case counts at the Veterans Home in Iowa facilities has changed over time. For example, last year, Public Health reported the first 2 outbreaks at the Veterans Home accounted for 67 infections. It has since revised that number to 48. Overall, in Iowa, there have been at least 59 COVID-19 outbreaks in Iowa nursing homes since the vaccine was first made available to healthcare workers in mid-December 2020. Currently, there are 2 Iowa homes in outbreak status, the public health says, which the agency defines as 3 or more infections among staff and residents. The Hubbard Care Center in Hardin County, where 4 residents and or workers are reported to be infected. A previous outbreak at the home last year resulted in 58 infections. The Montrose Health Care Center, where 12 residents and or workers are infected. A previous outbreak at that home last fall resulted in 40 infections. 4 of the 11 homes that have had 3 separate outbreaks over the course of the pandemic are located in Polk County. Bishop Drum Retirement Center with 121 infections, Fleur Heights Care Center 81 infections, Park Ridge Specialty Care with 80 infections, and Calvin Community with 79 infections. We're going to look quickly next at this date in history. On this date in 1934, federal prisoners landed on Alcatraz. On this date in 1965, the Watts Rebellion began. In 1973, hip-hop was born at a birthday party in the Bronx. On this date in 1973, the classic American movie American Graffiti opened. On this date in 2014, Oscar-winning actor Robin Williams died at the age of 63. In 1864, Confederate General Jubal Early abandons Winchester, Virginia. On this date in 1984, Ronald Reagan joked about bombing Russia. In 1980, Carol Bundy confesses her connection to the Sunset Slayer. In 1952, Hussein succeeded to the Jordanian throne. On this date, 1972, the last U.S. ground combat unit departed South Vietnam. On this date in 1806, Meriwether Lewis was shot in the leg. On this date in 1919, during World War I, the Weimar Constitution was adopted in Germany. And on this date in 1943, during World War II, the Germans began to evacuate Sicily. And again, that's just a handful of things that happened on this date, August 11th. Taking a look at the forecast for the next several days. Thursday, we can expect a high of 88 under mostly clear skies. 55 for a low tomorrow night. Friday, high of 82, mostly clear. Mostly clear Friday night, low of 56. Saturday, high of 82, and a low of 60 under mostly clear skies during the day. Partly cloudy at night, which continues into Sunday, high of 82 with a low of 62. Partly cloudy Monday, high of 80, low of 63 under mostly clear skies. Tuesday, mostly clear, high of 83 degrees. Very little in the way of rain chances over the next 6 or 7 days from the looks of things. So, not a whole lot to speak of when it comes to precipitation. That's going to bring us to the end of the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger with some help from the Daily Freeman Journal, Webster City, and the Marshalltown Times-Republican. Of course, this podcast and many others are available to you at iowaradioreading.org, and we certainly hope you're able to enjoy the podcast. We appreciate your continued support of IRIS, the Iowa Radio Information Service for the Blind. I'm going to be gone for Friday. You won't hear my voice. Hopefully they've got someone else to read for me. But you'll hear again from me come next Monday. Stay safe, stay healthy, stay cool, take good care of yourselves, and we'll talk to you again real soon right here on IRIS. Bye-bye for now.